myself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same, choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
Well, a very hearty welcome to everyone thinking clearly. This is your host, Bob Frelich, and I'm flying solo tonight because co-host Julia Mitten's not able to be here with us. So I got my wings strapped on, ready to go, and I'll tell you a little bit about what's happening on this edition of Thinking Clearly. First of all, a little business that we like to do at the start of the show here, because we like to be interactive. We like to interact with you. We like to hear from you, and we like to get feedback on the show. So the way we do that is we have a Facebook page, and you can go to the Facebook search bar and type in Thinking Clearly Radio, and Julia and I will pop up. Well, our Facebook page is going to pop up. Or you can email us by emailing TC, that's for Thinking Clearly, TC@KMUD.org. We love to hear from you. And our podcast version of this show is available. We've done 22 podcasts now, and time flies. And you can get that by going to thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's Thinking Clearly, one word, .libsyn.com. Or you can just, if you have a podcast app, you can just type Thinking Clearly in there, and you'll eventually get to the podcast versions of our shows. And I'm going to be referring to those a little bit, because this is going to be a kind of a review. We've covered a lot of topics in our 22 episodes so far. I'm going to review a few of the more important kind of select kind of critical aspects of critical thinking to review and help anchor for you tonight. I'm going to start out with our description of critical thinking. This used to be a definition, but it got very long as we added on to it, so it's become our working description, and I'm going to go over the whole thing because this is kind of a review show. It starts out with kind of the nub core of critical thinking and goes like this. Critical thinking is a mode of thinking that uses the process of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of a robust cross-section of evidence relevant to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and beliefs. And that robust cross-section is in there for a purpose. That means that we're not going and just looking for the evidence that supports our preconceived notions of an issue, but we're doing a cross-section. We're looking at all the evidence, evidence which might support what we think we believe, and evidence which may not support it. So that's an important part and keywords in this description of critical thinking. And it goes on. The second part reads like this. Critical thinking also includes an awareness of and attempt to compensate for the vulnerabilities we all have in our thought processes, including cognitive biases such as confirmation bias. And we're going to talk and review a little bit about what confirmation bias is. But that's an important aspect, is to become aware of the psychology, the neuroscience, all the studies that are being done. This is a hot topic in the field of psychology, social psychology, cognitive psychology, neuroscience. It's a very hot topic nowadays because we are in an era, a post-truth era, an era where people are polarizing around different beliefs and using confirmation bias and what we call motivated reasoning. We'll get into that later in the show. So it's important to have some information about those studies. You know, how do we process information? How do we hold on to beliefs? How is our beliefs allied with the kind of tribes and subgroups that we affiliate with and that sort of thing? The rest of the definition goes like this. Our description goes like this. Effective critical thinking requires a certain minimum amount of basic literacy in the content areas related to the issues that we're examining and requires willingness to be a lifelong learner. Now, that's really important. And what it means is that we can't really talk much or process our beliefs or get into the evidence to support a conclusion unless we have some basic idea, some basic information about the topic. So if what we're talking about is whether a drug is effective to treat a certain disease, we have to know a little bit about studies, the different kinds of studies that go into supporting whether a drug or a medication is important, effective, safe for certain disease processes. So if it's a science question, you need to delve into that science a little bit. If it's a policy issue, a political policy issue, then that's the kind of information that you need to become aware of. And the way we do that is being curious, natively, naturally curious about something, digging in. The internet provides such a wholesome, wonderful resource for doing research. It can also lead us astray, so you have to be careful and you have to know how to use the internet appropriately. And we've also done shows on that. I'll talk a little bit about that later. The last part of the description goes, when communicating our ideas using critical thinking, we are willing to acknowledge and evaluate evidence that may be contrary to our conclusions and consider alternative conclusions and beliefs. And that's sort of the mindset of a critical thinker. In other words, we don't go into an issue saying, we know everything about this, nothing's going to change our mind, we're going to persuade the other people that our position is right. Go into critical thinking, you're really doing a search for the truth. And you're being open to evidence which may disconfirm a belief that you have. And that flexibility, that willingness to change, that willingness to get more information, hear more, alter your position a little bit is an important part of critical thinking. So what I'm going to do is just go real briefly. I'm not going to spend any time with these, but I do want to go over some of the topics that we have discussed on this show. And when we started our show, we thought, well, critical thinking, how many topics can you come up with critical thinking? It seems like it's just pretty straightforward. But as we went on, we found that there were more and more relative topics, and one topic led to another. And so we have a list of about 15 or 16 topics that are going to come up in the future, and we keep adding to that. So I'm just going to go over some of the things that we've, topics and information that we've discussed in the 22 Thinking Clearly episodes that we've done. We started out by defining and describing critical thinking and discussing its importance. And as time has gone on, it's become much more clear in my mind how important critical thinking is. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. We've examined types of arguments. Now, not the yelling, screaming types, but the type that consists of statements that may be true or may be false, and those are called premises, that logically support our conclusions. Both premises and conclusions are referred to as claims. So if someone's making a claim, it may be that they've created an argument which led to this conclusion, and that's their claim, or their evidence. Their premises may be considered claims, too. So we'll talk a little bit, after I get done with this survey of what we've covered, talk a little bit about claims and the difference between premises and conclusions. We've talked about doing internet research, as I discussed, and we had a great guest, Tim Miller, digital media and learning librarian from Humboldt State University, come on, and he helps graduate students with doing research and that sort of thing, and he gave us some tips about doing internet research. There's a lot to using the internet. It's a wonderful resource, but it can lead us astray. So you have to be careful about how you vet the information that you're getting from the internet. And we've talked a lot about research findings in the field of human and behavioral sciences that relate to our cognitive abilities and vulnerabilities, and we'll review a few of those tonight. And we've examined the strengths and weaknesses of intuition, which we have adopted the phrase fast thinking, and that phrase is used a lot for the idea of conveying something that we quickly come up with an answer, and it's an intuitive answer. And that's as opposed to rational analysis, which is taking more time, being more deliberative in our reasoning process. And that is, what do you think, called slow thinking. In fact, that's the name of a book by psychologist Daniel Kahneman. He's a Nobel Prize winner, a psychologist, but he won that Nobel Prize in the field of economics because it considerably changed the approach and theories in economics. And the name of that book is Thinking, Fast and Slow. And we've contrasted critical thinking, which has the goal of understanding and truth-seeking, with things like rhetoric and propaganda, both which have the goal to persuade, and propaganda has the goal to control. And we've examined types of processes that can be used in rhetoric and propaganda. And one is framing and the other is narratives in human communication. We gave some examples of those. And we've gone behind the headlines to examine the principles, practices, and ethics of journalism in relation to critical thinking. We had shows on the scientific method with evidence-based practices and policies, and we had a great guest, Dr. Stephen Novella, who's a professor of medicine, and he's the founder of Evidence-Based Medicine, a great website that lives up to its title. We had another guest whose name was Steve Sloman. He's the co-author of a book called The Knowledge Illusion, and we'll talk a little bit tonight about what some of his findings were and what that means, the knowledge illusion. And we've had shows on false beliefs that we commonly think are true. That was a fun show. And we had a show on how we mostly use motivated reasoning to confirm our beliefs rather than impartially use critical thinking to seek the truth of a matter. And we also had a show on demystifying the California Common Core, which has as one of its standards critical thinking. We did a show on the differences between descriptive claims and normative claims. Descriptive claims are claims about the way the world is, what's out there, okay? More straightforward use of critical thinking versus, and those are facts, factual kinds of claims, and we look for evidence to support our conclusions, versus how the world should be. This is the is-ought question. How should the world be? What kinds of laws should we make? How should people act? Those are values-based, human values-based ideas. And so that's a little different than just straightforward critical thinking. And there's been a lot of philosophers who have spent many, many philosopher lives on arguing about and giving arguments and thinking about ways that we can do moral reasoning. And we're going to do in a future show, we're going to get a philosopher on and talk about moral reasoning. Those are questions that have to do with values, ethics, morality, aesthetics, and law. And we had a three-part series of shows on having civil dialogues. And last month, we had a show on the importance of recognizing the role of worldviews as we encounter new information and are in dialogue with others. So you see, in this progression, one topic has sort of led to another, and we'll see where it leads us in the future. I've got some ideas about what we're going to do next month, and that'll come up during the show here. And in doing these topics, we had a stream of great guests, and we want to continue that. Guests that who are experts in the topics that we've covered. So I want to point you to, again, our podcast version of this show, at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. You can listen to or download at no charge any and all of the previous episodes that we've done. So tonight I'm going to do some reviews of some key issues and topics that we've covered on this show, just as a review, selected a few that I want you to think about and hoping that you're practicing on and getting more information. And by the way, on our Facebook page, we do post additional links and resources for information about each show. And then somewhere around, 7:45, 7:50, we'll open the phone lines. I'll announce that and take your questions about anything critical thinking, any topic we've covered, any question that you have related to critical thinking, or you can tell us what other topics you'd like to us to investigate on Thinking Clearly shows in the future. So I'm going to start out by answering a question that Julia asked me during our last show. Now, she's not here, but hopefully she'll hear this show and get the answer to her question. What happened was she asked me this question right at the end of the show, and we had a caller on the line. We were just about done with the show, so I gave the briefest of all superficial answers to that question, but it was a wonderful question, and so I thought a little bit about it, and I want to answer it a little more completely than I did. And the question was, Bob, why is critical thinking important to you? And that's a great question, and it's probably take the whole show to do it, but I'm going to kind of summarize as best I can my thoughts on that. And it relates to, we did a show, Julia and I did a show on worldviews, and we kind of shared our worldviews, and it relates to my worldview, because my hope is that humanity will survive and thrive for a good long time into the future, for the long haul. And if we're going to do that as a species, then we're going to have to learn to reduce our polarization and enhance our cooperation way past where we are right now. We have all the tools in terms of critical thinking, resources for information, access to information. We've got the tools available, but we are getting into, we have moved into an era where we are so highly polarized, our beliefs are different from other people's to the degree that we completely dismiss those other people's beliefs and don't even want to talk to them. In fact, we want to shut them down. We want to shut them up. And that is happening to a large degree. And it's very toxic in terms of, I think, the long-range survival and thriving of humanity. So that has a lot to do with my belief in the importance of critical thinking. And I'm talking about this taking place locally, countrywide, global-wide, because critical thinking is evidence-based, as I mentioned in the description, and it uses universal principles of logic. So it's kind of a universal way that anybody can learn, and it's as opposed to dogma or ideology, which is local. Their different areas have different dogmatic ideas built into their subcultures and different religious beliefs and that sort of thing. And those are oftentimes what foster the separation and the polarization. But we can get around that. We can mitigate for that. And the way to do that, in my opinion, is through learning and practicing critical thinking, because it's a universal language of reason. So it's the best chance, in my opinion, for people to find common ground, to mutually agreed upon solutions to problems, instead of becoming increasingly polarized. I think critical thinking can transcend those more localized religious or cultural or political differences. So that's my more long-winded answer to that question of why I think critical thinking is important. So I'm going to start out with something very basic. It's so basic, it's so obvious that oftentimes we forget to do it, and that's to define our terms. So one very important starting point for critical thinking, if you're assimilating information, taking in information, or if you're in discussion, if you're giving information, if you're in a discussion with people and it's a back and forth, for example, about any topic that may be have some depth to it, then it's very important to be able to identify what the keywords there are there and make sure that you have a definition for that. You know what you mean, but does the other person know what you mean? They may have their own entirely different meaning, and I've experienced this a number of times where the feeling was that we were talking past each other, and we spent 30 minutes, 35, 40 minutes until we got to the idea that maybe we're actually defining these terms differently. How do you define that? So you can actually start your communication out, or actually if you're reading something, for example, how's the person define the key words? So defining terms is really important. Also important is to just be able to recognize claims, premises, and conclusions. Remember, premises are the statements that set forth the reasons or evidence, and the conclusion is the statement that the evidence is claimed to support or imply. Now, that's a that's a definition from A Concise Introduction to Logic by Patrick Hurley. And if you want to get more in-depth in logic, that's a wonderful book, A Concise Introduction to Logic by Hurley, H-U-R-L-E-Y. So just as an example, and it's good to just practice this when you're hearing people or reading something that appears to be an argument, and in other words, have evidence with logics linked to a conclusion that the person is making, then as an exercise, as a practice, look for what are the premises and what are the conclusions. There's some keywords. So I'm going to read something, and this is from actually a website called debate.org, which is an interesting website. Different people get up there, and they make a statement that they want to argue, and they'll give their argument, and then other people will give counterarguments and that sort of thing. So it's a great way to practice critical thinking or presenting arguments. So, for example, in a conversation about from this website about building border walls, a person says something like this. Quote, we should build walls on our borders because if someone wants in, they can come in legally. And besides, building the wall will save money for the U.S. Now, I just took a couple premises. This person was kind of using the shotgun approach, throwing out a whole bunch of claims or premises, and then coming to a conclusion. So what is the conclusion there? Again, I'll read it. We should build walls on our borders because if someone wants in, they can come in legally, and besides, building a wall will save money for the U.S. So because is a key word there to help identify which is the premise and which is the conclusion. So the conclusion is we should build walls on our borders. And the evidence or the premises are, number one, if someone wants in, they can come in legally. And number two, building a wall will save money for the U.S. Now, that's an argument, not a good one, because the premises really don't link well to the conclusion, and there are some missing premises in there, and we could talk in more detail about this argument, but I don't really have time to do that. The key here and the point I'm trying to make is that it's just good practice to be able to look at a statement that looks like it's an argument and to determine which are the premises and which are the conclusions. Usually there's more than one premise, but there is, per argument, just one conclusion. If you have more than one conclusion, then you have more than one argument. All right, going through this kind of quickly, but we discussed in episode number 3 of Thinking Clearly way back with HSU philosophy professor Benjamin Schaefer, we discussed the different types of arguments and talked about deductive and inductive arguments. So it's important to know the difference between them. You can get into logic and argument analysis very, very deeply. It's a very rich, robust topic and subject and intriguing in many, many ways. But you don't have to be a logician to be a good critical thinker. You just have to know some basic things about how logic is used to link the evidence, the premises, to the conclusions. So let's listen to a brief description of this from Dr. Kevin De LaPlante. He's a philosopher and a creator of Critical Thinker Academy and the Argument Ninja podcast. Wonderful, clear thinking person with great accessible and articulate descriptions of things. And he's going to be our guest next month, talking about tribalism and polarization and how that affects critical thinking. He was a guest, so he's a return guest. He was a guest on podcast episode 15, if you want to go back and listen to that. And this clip is from the Critical Thinker Academy archives. So let's listen to Kevin De LaPlante.
What's the difference between a deductive argument and an inductive argument? The difference has to do with logical relationship between the premises and the conclusion. Now, in a deductive argument, the intention is for the conclusion to follow from the premises with certainty. And by that we mean that if the premises are all true, the conclusion could not possibly be false. So the inference isn't a risky one at all. If we assume the premises are true, we're guaranteed that the conclusion will also be true. Here's a simple, well-worn example. All humans are mortal. Socrates is human, therefore Socrates is mortal. If we grant both of these premises, it follows with absolute deductive certainty that Socrates must be mortal. Now, by contrast, with inductive arguments, we don't expect the conclusion to follow with certainty. With an inductive argument, the conclusion only follows with some probability, some likelihood. This makes it a risky inference in the sense that, even if the premises are all true, and we're 100% convinced of their truth, the conclusion that we infer from them could still be false. So there's always a bit of a gamble involved in accepting the conclusion of an inductive argument. Here's a simple example. 90% of humans are right-handed. John is human, therefore John is right-handed. This conclusion obviously doesn't follow with certainty. If we assume these two premises are true, the conclusion could still be false. John could be one of the 10% of people who are left-handed. In this case, it's highly likely that John is right-handed, so we'd say that, while the inference isn't logically valid, it is a logically strong inference. On the other hand, an argument like this is not strong. Roughly 50% of humans are female. Julie has a new baby, therefore Julie's baby's female. In this case, the odds of this conclusion being correct are only about 50%, no better than a coin toss. Simply knowing that a baby is human doesn't give us good reasons to infer that the baby is a girl. The logical connection is too weak to justify this inference. These two examples show how probability concepts play a role in helping us distinguish between logically strong and logically weak arguments. Now, I want to draw attention to two different aspects of inductive reasoning. When you're given an inductive argument, there are two questions that have to be answered before you can properly evaluate the reasoning. The first question is this: how strong is the inference from premises to conclusion? In other words, what is the probability that the conclusion is true given the premises? Now, this was easy to figure out with the previous examples, because the proportions in the population were made explicit, and we all have at least some experience with reasoning with percentages. If 90% of people are right-handed, and you don't know anything else about John, we just assume there's a 90% chance that John is right-handed, and a 10% chance that he's left-handed. We're actually doing a little probability calculation in our head when we draw this inference. This is where probability theory can play a useful role in inductive reasoning. For more complicated inferences, the answers aren't so obvious. Now, the other question we need to ask about inductive arguments isn't so easy to answer. The question is, how high does the probability have to be before it's rational to accept the conclusion? This is a very different question. This is a question about thresholds for rational acceptance. How high the probability should be before we can say, okay, it's reasonable for me to accept this conclusion, even though I know there's still a chance it's wrong. In inductive logic, this is the threshold between strong and weak arguments. Strong arguments are those where the probability is high enough to warrant accepting the conclusion. Weak arguments are those where the probability isn't high enough.
All right. Now, I know that's a lot to take in over the radio, but there are, if it's enough to sort of pique your interest a little bit, there are many, many good books on logic, simple presentations of logic having to do with critical thinking. But the thing to realize is probably that we're not going to see a lot of real deductive arguments. Most of the arguments you're going to see in real life are going to be inductive arguments, and so they're based on probability. That's another thing, is that understanding probability and understanding that we live in a probabilistic universe, meaning that the best we can do sometimes is to have a good amount of probability that our conclusions are true. And that's an inductive argument. That's an inductive reasoning process when you're doing that. In a deductive, if your premises are true and the logic is valid, then your conclusions have to be true. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen all that much in real life. In real life, most of our arguments are inductive, and therefore we are supporting, not proving something, but supporting that it's true to a relatively high, whatever we consider what high enough is, degree of probability. Let's go on, and again, let me, I guess I did give you all, a couple resources for getting into these analysis and arguments and the details of that a little bit more. One is Kevin De LaPlante's Critical Thinker Academy, and it's a website, Critical Thinker Academy, all one word, criticalthinkeracademy.com. So Kevin has a lot of wonderful information on there that I think he describes very eloquently and articulately, and it's very accessible, even though you may have never had any logic. The other is a book that's called simply Critical Thinking by Brooke Moore and Parker. So Critical Thinking by Moore and Parker, I think, is if you really want to get into this subject more, that's an excellent text on critical thinking. I've given this quote before on a previous show, but I love it so much, and it's by one of my favorite people who is passed now quite a while back, Richard Feynman. He was an American physicist with a great sense of humor, well-respected. The Feynman lectures are still classics on topics, all topics of physics. And Feynman said, quote, he said, "The first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool," end quote. And that has to do with the kind of psychology that we have developed as human beings. Cognition that has gotten us a long ways, but has some vulnerability, has some bugs in it. And it's important to begin to understand what we're finding out about the research of how we think. That's called metacognition, thinking about thinking. So I'm going to get into just a few of examples of that. And it starts with the idea of intuitive fast thinking and the use of heuristics. Heuristics is a fancy-dancy word for mental shortcuts that give us rules of thumb, mental shortcuts that give us, provide approximate answers to a problem or a question. It's that fast thinking process. And it works so well and served us so well over our evolutionary history, but it can also lead us astray. Two heuristics that come to mind very commonly, you'll find them very commonly used, are the availability heuristic and confirmation heuristic. Now, when heuristics systematically cause errors, then they become known as biases. So there's the availability bias and the confirmation bias. So we're going to hear another clip. This is from study.com. It's kind of a simplified idea about what the availability heuristic is. And so we'll listen now.
What is more likely to kill you, your dog or your couch? We all know that dogs can be dangerous, and it's likely that you've heard stories of vicious dogs attacking humans. Naturally, the great majority of people would answer that dogs are more dangerous. Did you? In actuality, you are nearly 30 times more likely to die from falling off furniture in your own house than you are to be killed by a dog. This may seem unrealistic, but statistics show this is true. Take a look at these other hard-to-believe U.S. statistics. We are far more likely to be killed by hot tap water than a plane crash. Death from giving birth is more likely than death from accidental shooting. Alcohol poisoning is the cause of more deaths each year than being struck by lightning. Even after reading those statistics, it's doubtful that we'll become more frightened of our faucets than of getting on a plane. So why are we so likely to fear the more unlikely causes of death? Why are these statistics so difficult to believe? The answer lies in the way the human brain processes facts and makes decisions. Our brains use methods and strategies to speed problem solving. A heuristic is simply a term for mental shortcuts we take when making judgments and choices. Most of the time, these shortcuts serve us well in making decisions more quickly. Weighing out all the possible answers to any question or problem would take far too much time. A heuristic is a shortcut our brains use to make decision-making easier. Without heuristics, we would spend all our time judging a decision, leaving little time to act. The availability heuristic is one of these mental shortcuts often used by the brain. The availability heuristic judges the probability of events by how quickly and easily examples can come to mind. We make decisions based on the knowledge that is readily available in our minds rather than examining all the alternatives. Most of the time, our brains use the availability heuristic without us even realizing it. Often this gives our brains the quick shortcut to the answer we need, and in many cases, the judgments are accurate. However, as with any shortcut, sometimes the availability heuristic can lead us to make mistakes. Some events are easier to recall than others, not because they are more common, but because they stand out in our minds. This is especially true with sensational headlines related to injury or fatality, as mentioned in the statistics. There are many reasons that certain events stand out in our minds more than others. The following are a few of the more common reasons. Although a dull, unexciting event may be more common, vivid and more dramatic events come to mind more easily. For example, illnesses such as diabetes and stomach cancer kill more than twice the number of Americans than murder or car accidents. However, people see murder or car accidents as more dangerous and take more precautions against them. Murders and car accidents are very sensational and appealing to media reporters.
And not only media reporters, but we get manipulated all the time by this availability heuristic. For example, advertisers. Advertisers put their product out there and associate it with something. For example, an insurance company might run as an ad that shows people having an accident and then being reimbursed and taken care of in great shape, and they put their logo out there. So that, if it runs over and over again, becomes something that becomes very prominent to us. And so if we're thinking about how do I be safe, how can I keep my family safe, those kinds of things begin, images begin to pop into our minds. So advertisers know this and work with this kind of bias that we have, that what comes to mind is something that we will probably use in our decision-making process. So availability heuristic, and he didn't talk about confirmation, but confirmation heuristic is another thing that leads to what we call confirmation bias, which is defined as the tendency to search for, interpret, favor, and recall information in a way that confirms our pre-existing beliefs or hypotheses. In other words, being attracted to information that supports our pre-existing beliefs. So we gravitate towards those things that we already believe. And it's related to another phenomenon, which is called motivated reasoning. And motivated reasoning has sometimes been called confirmation bias on steroids. But this idea was discussed in motivated reasoning in a previous show, podcast number 17, by our guest, Professor Peter Ditto from UC Irvine. He heads up what's called the Hot Cognition Lab. Hot cognition, in Peter Ditto's terminology, is beliefs and things that we're attracted to for very intense emotional reasons, rather than reasoning them through critical thinking or using statistics to reason something through and see what the probability is of something happening. Motivated reasoning is defined as a form of reasoning in which people access, construct, and evaluate arguments in a biased fashion to arrive at or endorse a preferred conclusion. And that's a definition from Psychology Research and Reference that's at iresearch.com. And if that sounds familiar, you probably recognize it as something that somebody you know does, but we all do it. It's one of the most common phenomena that there is in terms of abuses of thinking something through using critical thinking, that we use motivated reasoning. So we've also had podcast number 14, Professor Stephen Sloman, who was a co-author of a book called The Knowledge Illusion. And the knowledge illusion is technically called the illusion of explanatory depth. Sloman, in this book, he talked about how we think we know a lot more than we do about every subject. We have a belief and we think we know a lot about it. We're so firm in that belief. But when asked to explain the details, most people cannot provide an adequate explanation. It's eye-opening to actually be asked the question, well, how does that really work? How does that policy that you advocate for really work? How is it going to make things better? So that's one thing that you can begin to do in that's called a debiasing strategy. You can do it with yourself by actually trying to write down or say into a tape recorder or something exactly how something works and figure out what you don't know about it or how little you really know about it. Most of our knowledge is distributed. It's in the collective somewhere. Now it's in the cloud. The cloud is part of our culture and part of the collective of information that's out there. Here's another clip that we're going to play from Kevin De La Plante talking about biases. He talks about the illusion of explanatory depth and how to develop critical thinking mindset based on an awareness of how our thought processes operate. And this knowledge allows us to begin to use some of those debiasing strategies to work around our natural biases. So let's take a listen to Kevin De La Plante again.
Biases are grounded in cognitive shortcuts or heuristics that are generally adaptive in a wide range of contexts. They're a feature of our design. They're not a bug, but they can and do have negative effects. And we want to minimize these effects when we can. Now, when it comes to overconfidence biases, like the illusion of explanatory depth, there is no easy debiasing strategy that can reduce the first-order effect. In most cases, our fast, automatic judgments of how much we understand about a particular topic are going to be too high. We'll overestimate how well we know what we think we know and underestimate how much we don't know. But what we can do is cultivate a second-order attitude toward our first-order judgments, namely that we should be skeptical of our first-order judgments. This is an example of what is sometimes called metacognition, thinking about thinking. Part of critical thinking is acquiring the right kinds of metacognitive habits of thought that will promote our critical thinking goals rather than inhibit them. And one important class of such habits of thought is our attitudes toward our own cognitive limitations. If someone asks me whether I think tighter gun control laws will be effective at reducing the number of mass shootings, I'm going to have an initial judgment about that, especially if I'm familiar with the general opinion of the leaders in my social tribe on this topic. But unless you're an actual social scientist who has studied the empirical data on this, or have made a serious commitment to acquiring a diverse background on the relevant social science, that initial judgment will be way overconfident. What the research on this cognitive bias shows is that if you're asked to actually explain the mechanism, give the causal story of how a change in the law will ultimately impact rates of mass shootings, you will struggle to assemble a coherent story about that. And your degree of confidence in your own understanding will drop as a result. That's the effect we see over and over in experimental studies. So my second order habit of thought should be to acknowledge this fact, that my understanding of this topic is shallower and less complete than I think it is, and act accordingly. Now, what does it mean to act accordingly? Well, it depends on the situation. At the very least, it means acting from a position of epistemic humility. Like if I generally lean pro-gun control, it could mean simply saying, I don't really know. I'm inclined to think it'll have some impact, but how much, I don't know. Or if I generally lean the other way, I might say, I don't really know. I'm inclined to think it won't have much effect, but I could be wrong about that. Now, this kind of measured, cautious response may not curry you any favors if your social tribe is a partisan tribe that has a more confident view on this, because there are strong incentives to signal your membership in the tribe by adopting a view that matches that confidence. But it is the more intellectually honest and honorable response, I believe, once you're aware of the biases in your own thinking.
That clip was just a portion of a much longer video that Dr. De La Plante has done. He does a video series on what he calls the Argument Ninja. He is attempting to set up a cognitive martial arts group and train people, teach people to do critical thinking, and actually teach them to be persuasive, too, in their arguments. And he calls that being an argument ninja. And that's part of the program that he has embarked on after he has left the university and is out there making it in the private world as a teacher and a leader in critical thinking. And I'm going to play one more clip from Kevin De La Plante. I know we're heavy in terms of Kevin here, but this is a little teaser because we're going to have him on as a guest in real life or via Skype anyway next month. He's into and done this video series on tribalism because he believes that it is it's critical to address at this stage of the game in terms of our political polarization that's happening not only in this country but worldwide. And so we're going to listen to a short clip from his latest sketchbook video called In Our Tribe We Trust. And I think that's about a 33-minute video, but we're going to listen to just a part of that. And in this, in the entire video, he begins with a statement: nuclear power should play a larger role in meeting our energy needs. And then he gets into how you would do a risk assessment, look at the benefits and risks involved, say, in nuclear power playing a larger role. And he goes through the process of how you would actually do that, pros and cons. And we're going to skip that part and then get into a little bit of commentary about how our beliefs are related to our various tribes that we identify with. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this clip. It's about just a little over 3 minutes, and then open the phone lines. So if you want to think about dialing 707 area code 923-3911, right after this, I will take your call.
If I start out pro-nuclear power, then I'm much more likely to judge the issue as high benefit, low cost. Someone who starts out with negative feelings about nuclear power is disposed to go the other way and judge the issue to be low benefit, high cost. Now, another cognitive shortcut we do to speed up the decision-making process is we just bypass the cost-benefit analysis stage altogether. Instead of engaging in any kind of conscious deliberation of pros and cons, we just survey our feelings about the issue. Mentally, we check the sign in those brackets. Is it positive or negative? Do we have positive feelings about nuclear power or negative feelings? How positive? How negative? If our feelings are positive, then we're inclined to answer yes to the question that was posed. If our feelings are negative, we're inclined to answer no. This is an example of a more general cognitive shortcut strategy called substitution, where our brains substitute a cognitively hard question, one that requires a lot of cognitive effort to answer, for an easier question, and use that as the basis for answering the hard question. In this case, the hard question is, should nuclear power play a larger role in meeting our energy needs? The easier question is, how do I feel about nuclear power? And all of this can happen in a fraction of a second without us realizing that this is what's going on. Now, someone can always ask us to justify our snap judgments after the fact, to elaborate on the pros and cons that informed our decision, but in snap judgments, we didn't spend any time thinking about the pros and cons. So the act of reconstructing our reasoning becomes an exercise in post hoc or after the fact rationalization, giving a public justification for a decision that was originally based on unconscious cognitive shortcuts. This act of reconstruction is constrained by the attractor states we mentioned, with positive feelings correlated with a high benefit, low cost assessment, and negative feelings with a low benefit, high cost assessment. Also, the strength of our feelings inclines us to weight the assessment in a corresponding way. Very strong positive or negative feelings means the assessment that we reconstruct has to heavily favor the pro or the con side. The angle of our seesaw is steeper. If the feelings are weaker, the assessment can be more balanced. This sets up conditions for a whole host of cognitive biases to come into play, to make it so that we arrive at the outcome that coheres with our emotional response. We start with this emotional response. In this picture, it's represented by the seesaw with the plus sign in the thought balloon over the guy's head at the top. That response disposes us to filter information in a particular way. We browse the internet, we talk to people, we read articles and books, and we're exposed to lots of information. But the effect of the filter is that we selectively remember and forget information. We selectively search for and seek out information. We selectively credit and discredit information. That will eventually result in an assessment of costs and benefits that coheres with, or we could say rationalizes, our emotional response. This is represented by the stream of green and red balloons that gets through the filter. That's the stream that ultimately winds up in our public justification for the judgment we made, which is represented by the speech balloon. This is an example of what psychologists call motivated reasoning. We're motivated to arrive at a judgment based on factors other than an impartial weighing of the evidence and the arguments. In this case, one of these factors is our brain's natural tendency to want to reduce cognitive dissonance, the stress that comes when there's an internal conflict between one's beliefs, feelings, and behavior.
Kevin De La Plante, and you can hear that entire video. It's intriguing, and he explains things, I think, very well. It's a 33-minute video, and a little easier because with the video, he has some visuals that help get his point across. And it's at his website, kevindelaplante.com. And you spell that kevindelaplante.com. Now, I'll put links to all the stuff that I have reviewed and talked about on this show. I know I've thrown a lot of things out there. It's coming kind of quickly. It's hard to get all this across in a show, an hour show, but it was meant to be a review, and it's meant to encourage you to go back to our podcasts where this information is treated in much more depth. Now, Kevin De La Plante, also you can go to YouTube and just be in Kevin De La Plante, and he has these video presentations on YouTube also. So if you want to give a call, I know we only didn't leave much time for you, but we got about 5 minutes, 707-923-3911. If you have any questions relating to topics that we've covered on this show, or if you have an idea for a topic that you'd like to see in the future of this show, we've got a long way to go. There's many, many topics that are related to the idea of critical thinking. Give me a call, and we'll have a discussion about it. While I'm waiting, I want to go back to a couple things. One of the things, and we did a whole show on this with an example topic of the difference between is and ought, the difference between how we use critical thinking to describe what is out there, that's called a descriptive approach, versus values, what we should do about something, the should or the ought, which is a lot more complicated subject as to how we actually reason that through. One of the more popular ways that's been developed is called consequentialism or utilitarianism, and that's that we should do the thing that benefits the most people the most. You know, what are the consequences of saying that we should have a law that mandates vaccinations in schools? That was the topic that we used as an example. Now, we don't care about one way or the other about discussing the topic itself, but discussing the process of how you actually reason that through. One of the things that I do want to leave you with, and I will interrupt this if we get a call, but I do want to take a brief look at sort of the evolutionary story of Homo sapiens, of our species. Some of the behavior and problem-solving ability through evolution has been wired into us. There are some kinds of behaviors that we get into that's reflexive and intuitive, and we've talked about some of that in terms of the availability heuristic, confirmation heuristic, and that those kinds of things. But as hominids, and hominids is just a fancy-dancy word for pre-humans, humans and all the extinct relatives that have led to humans, as hominids continued to evolve, basically we've become social animals, and the social groups having higher amounts of social organization including cooperation and specialization of roles, gained a natural selection advantage over species that were less organized into groups. And I could go on with this, and I will at some time, some future show, because it's an important concept, but we have a caller. So welcome to Thinking Clearly. The caller is gone. Okay. Well, I'll continue then. I got a couple minutes here. And if the caller calls back, I'll take the call briefly. But basically what happened to us as a species is there was kind of a repurposing of some of our existing cognitive abilities that allowed us to share and pass down information and practices, which triggered this biological and cultural co-evolution so that our culture and our biology co-evolved. And that's what's given us this incredible amount of ability to control our environment. So did you say we have the caller back? Okay, caller, you've got just like 30 seconds. I'm sorry, but go ahead. Give it to me.
It's Julia, and I always wanted to be the last-minute caller.
Okay. All right, Julia. How you doing?
I have another question for you real quick. You answered my question very well earlier.
Well, it's got to be a brief. I probably won't answer it this show, but go ahead. What is it?
No, don't answer it this show. My question is, why should critical thinking be important to somebody else?
Oh, great. All right. Well, we'll leave that suspended in the air, Julia.
I'll leave you with that.
Okay. Thank you. And that'll do it for Thinking Clearly. See you next month.
Think for yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan. 'Cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People Powered Radio.